Jim Brown with another Outrig Capercast. Let's just see if I can keep this up for another year. Actually, I'm enjoying it. I hope you are. As you'll recall, we are embarked upon a series of audio updates to the chapters in my book, Among the Multihulls. We're calling this the next last chapter. This is the next last chapter 4, which is the story of Wana, our little 24-foot Arthur Piver-designed Nugget Trimaran. Now, those of you who are regular listeners will recall that I've told this story, the story of the voyage itself, in a much earlier podcast, back I think it was number 4. And I will lift brief portions of that story for use here, but what I really want to do is continue setting the scene. That is, trying to place the advent of the modern multihull into some kind of historical context. For I believe that these boats really are a product of their times. Now, when I started building Wana back in 1958 in Fred Jukitz's sign shop, I didn't say much about what I intended to do with the boat. Arthur Piver knew, and so did Fred Jukitz, but that was about it. I was just building myself a big trimaran, big at the time, 24 feet. And it was while building the boat that I bumped into Joanna, which turned out to be a significant interruption. Yes, we met at a party, one of those famous Sausalito houseboat parties. And after my little houseboat sank in that tsunami from the Alaskan earthquake, I moved downtown, rented a wonderful apartment on the stern of the South Shore, a big old Sacramento River potato barge. She was about 75 feet long, had 3 apartments built into her, upstairs, downstairs, and the bow. So I had neighbors, but my apartment was definitely of a sort where I could, without shame, entertain a girlfriend. Now, this boat was lying afloat, whereas right across the slough, just next to where we were tied up, lived the lumber schooner Lassen. And she was lying in the mud, all being eaten up by the worms and slowly dissolving into the bay, but it still had several apartments on board, one of which was directly, almost within spitting distance of where we lived, and the fantail of the vessel had broken and fallen off into the sea, so that there was, in that apartment, there was actually water coming into the living room at high tide. Did I tell you about the Lassen? She was about a 200-footer, all-wooden lumber schooner that had been in service right up through the 1930s, hauling lumber down from probably Crescent City, California. Did I tell you about Lassen's last trip? I can't remember. I'll be brief. Her hold was loaded plumb full with lumber, and it was stacked up high on deck so that the helmsman could not see where the vessel was going. All the helmsman could do was just, read the compass. Well, after they rounded that great Northern California cape called Mendocino, the skipper gave the helmsman a course and retired. The course was direct for the lightship off of San Francisco. Sure, there was a lookout on the bow. They steered for many hours. The watchman on the bow fell asleep. The skipper stayed asleep, and the helmsman rammed the lightship. After steering a compass course for a couple of hundred miles, the ship rammed the lightship. That's pretty good steering. It was a terrible glancing blow that sent the Lassen reeling, and she dumped much of her deck cargo off of the deck in the collision, which lumber, incidentally, was blown ashore and used to build the little village of Pacifica, just 10 miles south of the Golden Gate, now a terribly overcrowded bedroom community. Well, when Joanna and I got married early in 59, the word got out that we were going to get into this little boat and sail away together, at which point we started to get some static from our friends. You're going to take that catamaran thingamajig out in the ocean? Come on. Meanwhile, I was doing everything I could to get the darn thing built, having to go off to work every now and then. These were the days when a roustabout guy could get a job in one day that paid pretty well. A booming economy. $3 an hour was a living wage. And besides, Joanna had a good job as a teacher. She was a grade school teacher over in San Francisco. Commuted every day in her big-ass Buick Roadmaster, a four-holer convertible, where if you push the electric buttons to make the seat go up and down, instead the top would go up and down. It was a very noble old car whose name was Simón Bolívar. She had a little money stuck away in her teacher's retirement fund, and she was game, boy. She wanted adventure. We were both 25. We had spent too much time alone. I often wished that I had someone to share my life with, and now we figured we could really pull this caper off until it became clear that she was pregnant. And by the time I got the boat finished, she was like 5 months pregnant. And we were still determined to go, and boy, now we started getting all kinds of flack. If I had built a little 24-foot monohull, there wouldn't have been any problem. But, oh my, we knew a very experienced, older cruising couple who had a nice monohull and had been up and down the western seaboard a couple times. They invited us aboard one night for dinner. We had a nice talk with them, and they gave us a lot of good information. But before it was all over, they told us, you know, you better be prepared, because it's likely you're going to have to swim for your lives. And my old friend, Dick Homestead, said, Jim, are you telling me you're really serious about this? You're going to do this? And other friends said, oh, no, not with Joanna, not in her condition. And Joanna did some reading and learned that there are apparently some peasant women who work in the fields and give birth and get up and go back to work in the fields. She took some confidence in that. She was having some prenatal care by a doctor, and she explained to him that we were going on a cruise. And the doctor said, oh, will there be a doctor on board? Joanna just stopped going. Of course, we took it seriously. We talked about it a lot, and it was arranged that whenever the time was right, if she felt like she ought to get off of the boat at any point, that we would simply stop and, you know, have the baby there, wherever it happened to be. We were terribly naive, but we were also pathologically committed. There was just no way we were going to let something as natural as childbirth interfere with our lives. Yawk, yawk. It turned out that people were giving Arthur Piver a lot of water about this. And he came to see me one time when the boat was nearly finished and said, well, you know what I tell him, Jim? I tell him that Jim Brown, this is a quote, Jim Brown is a brave young man with motives of his own. And he would just drop it there. One thing for sure, my dad, who was, you know, in San Francisco, gave us lots of support, lots of encouragement, kept showing up with things we needed on the boat. But because of Joanna's condition, we really didn't know how capable she would be of standing a watch. She was getting pretty big now. 5.5 months along when we finally got ready to go, and I figured we needed another crew, so I invited our friend Dick York to go along with us. He agreed. So with three of us in a 24-foot open boat with just two bunks, in July of 1959, we sailed out the Golden Gate and turned left. And it wasn't long before we learned what it was like to sail a little multi-hull downwind, hard downwind in the open sea. And I don't think I can tell the story any better than I did over a year ago in podcast number 4. I'll lift a piece of that out of there and put it in here. The real thing I would like to tell you about what the sensations were like for us to ride big waves in a little boat while sailing at the same speed as the seaway. It was like, well, like this. By mid-afternoon, it was blowing at least a steady 25 with 7 to 9 foot white horses, and Juana was diving off of the crests and streaking for the troughs. It was the most terrifying thrill on this planet. I mean, there we were, running hard in a little boat, an open boat. If any of those waves had overwhelmed us from astern, the boat would have been completely inundated. The water would have poured right into the cockpit. And the cockpit was contiguous with the cabin. There was no cockpit bulkhead, no self-bailing. A boarding wave would completely downflood the main hull. Of course, at that point, I knew we wouldn't sink. The floats would hold us up. And with a great deal of difficulty, we probably could bail out the main hull and continue. But from my monohull experience, of course, I realized that we were probably in a precarious position. But as every wave loomed up astern, Wana would just run away from them. Because we were moving at more or less the same speed as the seaway, which in those conditions was probably in the mid-teens, the waves did not sweep down upon us. Now, neither Dick nor I had ever sailed in any such conditions in such a boat, and it took us a while. We had to pinch our noses in order to realize that everything was going along just fine. Of course, the boat required very careful steering, and we traded helm tricks of no more than an hour apiece. As the afternoon wore on, the wind did not increase. It never really hit 30 knots, but the seaway became more mature. Instead of short, angry wind waves, they developed into mature rollers, and boy, oh boy, they were far apart and moving fast. And now the boat began to offer us some rather disorienting sensations. As the boat would catch a wave, we would be hurled forward with almost head-snapping acceleration, but at that very moment, it seemed like we were dead in the water. The sails would go slack, and the helm would go mushy. But then, as we went diving for the troughs, we sensed a strange deceleration, but the sails would fill with wind with a pop, and the boat was streaking through the water, great veils of spray coming off of all three hulls, and the helm was hard as a rock, like we were fastened to a rail. We'd go bucking over potholes and speed bumps in the trough, and at times try to overtake the wave ahead, and the boat would threaten to dive into its back, but she never did. And these strange reversing sensations were at their height when we would go over the falls. Let's say we were running along in the trough at great speed with a crest before us, a crest behind, and as they subsided, another crest was developing underneath us. There we would be pirouetting right on the lip of the cornice, and as it broke, we'd go diving into the foam, spindrift streaking across the decks, and we would plunge into the abyss ahead as it ran away. And so did we, leaving an acre of froth behind us from the broken wave. Now, as dusk approached, the wind abated a bit, but the seaway did not. We were still sailing in an endless supply of white horses coming on from behind. And after a while, I thought it was not like sailing with white horses, but maybe running with the bulls at Pamplona. But the boat kept telling us that everything was going along just fine. Well, still today, 50-some years later, just telling of it sends knots in my stomach.
By about a year later, the Nugget trimaran had been redesigned, evolved to include a cockpit bulkhead and a self-bailing feature that included a huge superstructure with bunks in the wings and all of that stuff. It seemed to me to be trying to do way too much with a boat of a given size. And that was just the beginning of the roomaran or condomaran phenomenon that I'll have more to say about later. Well, getting back to the voyage now, after we rounded Point Conception and sailed into the protected conditions of the Santa Barbara Channel, we felt pretty good about the boat. Boy, she had showed us that she could really contend with high speeds and sailing in wave currents. But as we proceeded south from Ensenada down along the coast of Baja California, the conditions got desperately hot and desperately light. We were going nowhere fast, and it looked like we were not going to be able to get to Panama by Joanna's birthing time. And the main problem was that we were sailing at the wrong time of year. During their Mexican storm season, there's very little wind unless there's a storm. But the next thing that happened on our little coastal voyage was that we lost the boat. For the full story, you'll have to go back to podcast number 4 or 5. But I want to include the highlights of the episode here. One afternoon, we spotted an oasis ashore Otherwise, the whole coastline at that time of year looked like a slag heap. But we were rather desperate to get off of the boat and maybe find something cold to drink. So we went ashore, and I made the very bad decision of leaving the boat alone in an unprotected anchorage overnight. Here's what happened the next morning. Well, dang it, Christy can't find what happened the next morning, not from a previous podcast. I know I've told you about it before. I'll spare you the exchange I've had with Christy over this issue and just tell you about it again right here. We had a wonderful time ashore that night before with the locals in this very remote little town, Todos Santos. Of course, since it has become quite a hot spot. But we were having breakfast the next morning in this colonial ruin of a hotel when in walked the guy that had brought us into town the day before in his Jeep. He looked at us quite surprised and said, "Oh, I thought you'd gone. Your boat is gone." Oh, man, we jumped in his Jeep and went running back down to the beach. Out in sure as hell the anchorage was bare. Now, from this beach, which they now call Playa Lobos, it is open sand to the north for many miles, but to the south, just to the south, there's a promontory, Punta Lobos. And from there south, the coast is craggy for many miles. But up on this promontory, we could see several people looking out to sea. They were looking for our boat. So we left poor Joanna sitting in the sand, and Dick and I climbed up on the promontory, looked out to sea. About 2 miles out, there was a line of haze. We couldn't see far to seaward, but we could see way up and down the coast. There was no boat in sight. But there was an old guy up there, a shark fisherman, who said that he could see the boat. Well, I got down behind his shoulder and looked just where he was pointing, and I couldn't see the boat. I began to suspect that someone had taken it. But this old guy, who we came to call Strong Eyes, offered to borrow an outboard motor and take us out there and bring the boat back. Put it on his skiff, you know, and bring the boat back. Well, Dick and I decided on a two-pronged search. He would go with Strong Eyes out beyond the haze line in a motorboat, and I would hike down the coast and look in every crag I could find to see if the boat had been pulled up on the sand or if it was all busted up in the surf someplace. So that's the way it went. I started hiking, and I watched Dick and Strong Eyes disappear out of sight into the haze. And by early afternoon, I was really bushed and just terribly distressed about losing our boat. Not only that, but before we took off, Joanna reminded us that our thin pack of traveler's checks was on board. So I went scrambling through the desert over one pile of rocks after another, until early afternoon when I was bushed and I just had to start back. I was in sandals, no water, and it was late afternoon before I got back to the beach. Joanna was sitting in the sand with her elbows on her knees and her head on her forearms, and when I called to her and approached, it was clear that to her that I hadn't found the boat. And she explained that she had not been there all day, that a family had taken her to their home nearby, put her up in the shade, you know, kept her fed and watered, treated her delightfully, and said, "You know, if you've lost your boat, you don't have to go back to California to have your baby. You can have your baby here. Stay in Todos Santos. Live with us." And I must say that was very comforting, and I often have wondered how different our lives would have been had we stayed. You know, we might still be there. But right then there came a shout from up on the promontory. There were people still up there. They'd been there all day, Joanna said, looking for our boat. I couldn't understand what they were saying, if something about pájaro, bird. They were waving their arms and pointing out to sea, and our friend with the Jeep was there too, and he said, "They say your boat looks like a bird. They are bringing your bird." Oh, my God, what another tremendous reprieve. Well, to keep it short, we sailed out of that anchorage that night and continued on down the coast. There was a change in the weather. We had a breeze. We kept our eyes peeled for the beacon on the tip of Baja California at Cabo San Lucas, later learned that it was not operating. And by the time the dawn came up, it was clear we had passed the tip of Baja and we were out in the Gulf of California. The sky was ablaze with crimson clouds in the sunrise. Down to the southwest, we could see a huge column of clouds that looked like a giant stadium on fire. and there was a very long swell approaching from that direction. It was clear that we were looking at the makings of the Mexican Chubasco, their autumnal hurricane. And now there came a point of decision. Never before or since have I felt the pressure of responsibility more than at this time, when we had to choose between sprinting for the Mexican mainland some 200 miles away, or return back to the tip of Baja California, which was maybe only 10 miles back. Okay, this was to be a coastal voyage, and we had been secure up to now, but this was the longest open water passage of our whole trip to Panama. And here we were staring at the makings of a major storm. On the mainland, we could have found a protected harbor, but there at the tip of Baja, there is an anchorage, okay, but it is totally unprotected from the south. Nonetheless, I had to choose to go back. We might lose the boat, but we had to at least get Joanna ashore. So we sailed back to this great Cape San Lucas, now the site of the thriving resort called Cabo. But for us, the place was remarkably desolate. There was a ramshackle tuna cannery on the beach with an iron wharf sticking out into the raging surf. That long swell was exploding on the rocks of Cape San Lucas and on the beach. The anchor went down into deep water. We were right outside the surf line. And with your patience, I will insert here the way I told the story over a year ago of what happened next to us there in September 1959. So I put on my fins, mask, and snorkel, and managed to power through the surf. I got thumped on the sand a couple of times getting in, but the next thing I knew, I was standing, dripping wet, in the office of the manager of the cannery. He was talking on the radio, a giant tube-type Apelco radio, talking about their preparations for the approaching storm. And when he finished, he turned to me and motioned out his window where we could see Juana bobbing in the swell out there. And he said, "We must to put your boat on the beach." And again, in that moment, I felt a tremendous relief and gratitude to the Mexicans. I explained, yes, the boat is very light, no heavier than a car, very shallow, no keel, but we need help. And he said, "We have 40 men here. You be ready, 4 o'clock. Well, without my swim fins, I never would have made it back out through that surf. We were ready all right by 4 o'clock. We had everything on the boat as waterproofed as possible in plastic bags, tied into the boat. And we had Joanna all trussed up in 4 life jackets to pad the baby. Before 4 o'clock, all the women and children began to gather on the beach. The wind was blowing strong enough so that their clothing was snapping in the wind. And at 4 sharp, a gang of guys came out of the cannery, came down to the beach. We had a ball of anchor line ready on the bow, ready to throw into the crowd. We got our other anchor up and shot the surf. It was like, you know, really speeding for a stone wall. But as soon as the boat grounded, I threw this ball of line into these hands that were all reaching up. There were guys even out in the water. And they snatched our boat up out of that surf and over the berm of the beach just immediately, while we were still on board. Dick and I jumped out, and Joanna was the last to emerge from the cabin, having removed all of her padding. And when the crowd saw that she was as big as a house, they just gasped, and the women moved in and ushered her away. And now the whole gang of us surrounded the boat. There wasn't 1 inch of the perimeter of that boat that didn't have hands on it, and there was a crowd still pulling on the line. And the foreman hollered, "Andale!" And that boat started moving up the beach, just being pushed through the sand. I swear we went for a quarter of a mile.
Well, looking back on it now, I would say, okay, an eighth of a mile. At least an eighth of a mile. Up the beach beyond the cannery to where there is now the dredged-out inner harbor at Cabo.
And a couple of guys came out of the cannery with long lengths of steel pipe and shovels, and they dug deep holes in the sand, so deep that they had to struggle to throw the sand out. They were down in the holes, and then they buried those pipes in the sand as dead men and lashed our boat down to the beach. Well, for the whole story, you'll have to go to the book or back to the early podcasts, but what have I told you these stories for? What is this all about, anyway? It's supposed to be about how multi-hulls emerged as a product of their times, right? Well, I'm just here to tell you that in the early days of trimaran seafaring, it's clear that we made a lot of dumb mistakes. I mean, there we were. In the space of 2 days, we had lost the boat and maybe almost lost ourselves. If we had sprinted for the Mexican mainland, we very well might have been destroyed. That storm went right up into the Sea of Cortez and blew the top story off of the Los Arcos Hotel in La Paz, blew down all the palm trees. Where we were, it blew part of the roof off the cannery, sandblasted the bark off of the tree, sandblasted the window panes so that you couldn't see out of them. But because of the graciousness of our Mexican hosts, when the sun came up the next morning, our boat was still there. But we were sailing in the wrong time of year, and it was clear to us now why it was the wrong time. We were really lucky to get away with this nonsense. It was the kind of trip that really tends to fry the minds of inexperienced people who sail off into such conditions. I knew just enough to get us into and out of real trouble. We left the boat there under controlled circumstances, actually stored undercover in a part of the cannery, and with considerable difficulty made our way back to California before our firstborn son, Stephen, came to be. We arrived in Sausalito with no money, no job, no place to live, no car. But we did have friends. I went to work, and with great good luck, I was able to go back to Mexico and retrieve the boat and bring it back to San Francisco Bay. And how all of that was accomplished is another chapter in the book. Anyway, I would like to try to explain why we were there in the first place. It had something to do with the ebullience and the confidence of post-war America. It had even more to do with the almost shocking difference in performance and seakeeping properties that I perceived in these early little trimarans. It made me feel invincible, which is a great virtue of youth, but revealed itself to be a great mistake. We learned the hard way that no matter the strength of one's will, we cannot change the cosmic nature of the planet. It is not like the ocean is a big toy to be enjoyed, and it is not out to get you, either. In the words of that great Maine troubadour, Gordon Bach, he sings of the ocean, "It don't know nor even care you're there." And then there's that old North Sea fisherman who said, "The sea is an absolute element. You may know of a bank where the fishing is good, but at the times of the full moon and the new moon, the tide runs hard over that bank, and if the wind is blowing hard against that current, if you take your boat onto that bank at that time, the only reason you don't lose that boat is because you got lucky." Well, we got lucky, and a year later, Arthur Piver crossed the Atlantic in his 30-foot nimble trimaran, and the year after that, he crossed the Pacific in his 35-foot Lodestar trimaran, all very crudely owner-built, and sailed with the help of his Viking-like crewman, Rich Girling, and another fair parcel of luck. And 8 years later, by 1968, Arthur Piver's luck ran out. Sailing single-handed, he sailed out the Golden Gate, turned left, and was never seen again. That almost stifled multi-hull development, but it was just a hiccup. By then, there were thousands of individuals building their own boats in their own backyards so that, as he would say, "For the price of an ordinary automobile, the world can be your oyster too, boy." and with the sort of qualifications I have tried to explain, that was true. He was a visionary. He knew what was going to happen. Just look what's happened since with lightweight seafaring. Well, okay, next time we get together, maybe we'll talk about how Sea Runner trimarans came to be. That, too, was not an auspicious beginning. But for now, Christie is bugging me to death to ask the man who called my track phone from Hong Kong with the offer of a donation of $100 to the tractor trailer project. We were unable to decipher your phone number because of reception here. And so please send your contact by email to my personal email address, which is outrig.org@gmail.com. We are grateful to you for your offer. Leaving messages on that track phone was a bad idea. But we are having some money come in. We're about halfway, but more than half grateful. So anyone who would like to support the tractor trailer project to the tune of $100 or so, that's earmarked expressly for our tractor trailer project, we will put your name on the credits screen for that video. We're told that if we can get the tractor trailer video, that we can get the money to put the whole Outrig collection online. That's our goal. Hey, we are grateful. Thank you. And here's to a good year coming, all right? Let's go sailing. Bye-bye.